John, the meeting is all yours.
Good morning. This is the public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee, and we are now in order. I would like to introduce the people at the head table. I'm Dave Rossum. I'm chairman of the committee. And on my left,
Bill Conway, member.
Sheila.
Sheila Scheinberg, consultant.
Jim Booker, consultant.
Per Peterson, member.
Rob Wellington, legal counsel.
Herman Wardell, consultant.
And I'm pleased to welcome Steve Chestnut from Diablo Canyon Plant, PG&E, who will be with us during the meeting and in the future. And Steve, if you have anything you'd like to say at this point, you're welcome to do it.
Yes, thanks for having me here, and I look forward to the meeting. Thanks.
Okay. I'm going to read the standard statement, even though no members of the public are here at the moment, but it is our practice to always read this statement at the beginning of every session. So here it is. Anyone wishing to address the committee on matters not appearing on the agenda may do so now. The public may comment on any matter listed on the agenda at the time the matter is being considered by the committee. There will be a time limit of not more than 5 minutes for each speaker. No action will be taken by the committee on matters brought up under this item, but they may be referred to staff for further study, response, or action. And the committee can at any time consider requests to change the order of a listed agenda item. And, of course, all the information distributed to the committee at a public meeting becomes part of the public record of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. A copy of written material, pictures, and so forth must be provided to the committee's legal counsel for this purpose. Thank you very much. Our first item of business is our consent agenda, and the first item under the consent agenda are the minutes of the previous public meeting. And that set of minutes was provided to all of us, and so we are now looking at minutes of the date. The meeting of June 20th and 21st, 2006. So, the first pink section of these minutes, we can review, as we have done in the past, by quickly going through page by page to see if there are any comments from the members, consultants, or counsel.
That's fine with me. I have comments, but it's perfectly fine with me if we want to go page
well,
by page.
Well, we'll go page by page rapidly if there's just editorial comments that you can provide to Mr. Wellington. You can decide whether to bring it up or feed it to him with your copy. So these are all under section B.9. We'll start with page 1. And I'll go quickly, and please sing out if you have any comments. 2. On page 3, Rob, we mentioned that Vice President Donna Jacobs received the award from the Women in Nuclear. That has a couple more words that should go with it. It's okay. Women in Nuclear, parentheses, WIN, Organization of the American Nuclear Society.
I have comments on that page,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. The first paragraph, relative to myself visiting along with legal counsel Wellington, it's to the California Energy Commission, not the California Attorney General's office. I have some wording I can give to you, Rob, if you want
okay,
to see what I have.
Great, thanks.
And at the midway through the paragraph where you see Alara in parentheses, there should be a capital R there. That's merely editorial. That's all I have on that page.
Sorry. Oh, down here.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Page 4. 5.
There's one that should be fixed there. The word FRM should be from, but I'll give that to Rob also.
Okay.
That's down on the next to last paragraph. next to my name.
Good catch. Page 6?
Page 6, at the top.
Okay.
First full sentence, starting with Mr. Wardell. It looks like a typo, but it really isn't. It's the last part of that sentence. Had this been an actual event rather than a drill, it should be, and I'll give these words to Rob, should read, had there been an actual event during the drill. In other words, during the drill, they advised everyone to be careful, the security guards be careful, to look to see if there were an actual event happening during the security drill.
That's an important point, and I found the sentence confusing, and now I understand it. It makes sense. Any other comments on page 6? 7.
7.
Yeah, that first paragraph there, the new engineer inadvertently inserted, that engineer did not insert that. The new engineer prepared a refuel. The new engineer prepared a fuel reload program, which allowed for inadvertent insertion of a bomb. I'll give you some words on that.
Thanks, Jim. That's the same thing I had, so. Sorry.
Okay, somebody down there?
No, fine.
The second paragraph, I don't think I understand. Is this a matter of replacing PIMS, or is there another system that I'm unaware of?
Where are you reading to?
Second paragraph. The computer system health report was in red status.
This is a process computer in controller.
Yeah.
That gathers all the data.
Well, this is something that is in line to be replaced soon, right?
Right.
I think we ought to clarify that, because it really it doesn't lead anywhere as it stands. Okay? Jim, you want to give Rob the words to just
I will.
Explain what the plan is for that. Anything else on page 7? 8. Page 9? 10. Doing pretty good. 11? 12? 13. Okay. 14. Page 15. Page 16 and 17. Okay, we're doing well. Keep going. 18, 19.
I'll make a comment on 19. Second to the last paragraph, starting with Mr. Kettleson.
Yeah.
Kent and I were just talking about this, and there was not an LER here. I'm not sure how to correct this, but there actually was not an LER for this ERDS system problem. I'm not sure where those words came from. You might want to take a look back at the transcript, Rob.
I think I was the one who queried on that one, and it was not an LER, but it was a report that you made to the commission. That's where I picked it up.
And that's correct.
It was erroneous.
Event notification,
yeah.
Phone call.
Yeah.
The licensing event reports are in the docket, the public record, aren't they?
That's correct.
And they all have dates. Why was there a question about provide dates of the LERs? Did that refer to just the one that was being talked about in the presentation? When you talk about an LER, provide the date for
it. It was confusing because it was never an LER.
No, I mean in this case, but the first sentence implies that a member of the public was asking for the dates of the LERs. If that meant, as I think it does, when we're discussing an LER to identify it by date, then I think we should do that. Otherwise, they're all identified by dates.
They do have dates.
Yeah.
And that was when the person addressed that to me, I answered that there were dates associated with the submittal on the form itself. So Mr. Kettleson happened to be in the area at the time, and I think that lends a bit to the confusion as to how it should properly be worded. It's really not an issue, and to your point, it's correct. They are dated.
Okay. Page 20?
No, I did note, I'm sorry, that this was corrected. 19, the remainder of the bold print agreed, Kettleson agreed to follow up and evaluate the wording. You did resubmit an event notification report. I saw that. So that's clear. That's clean.
Okay. Well, then 20 or 21? 22, is there a typo here? You see the bullet lists, and you've got QB on both of them. Do you mean to have it on both of them? QB's assessment? Or was that just continued?
Well, they're two different meetings, right? They're two different meetings.
Yes, that's correct. There are two references because of two different meetings.
Okay, I see that now.
That makes sense.
Okay. 23.
I don't have a comment on 23, but and maybe this is the wrong time to do this, but it seems like an advantageous time. The top of the page, the very last sentence in that partial paragraph, talks about mispositioning events which occurred during the Unit 2 outage will receive a complete root cause evaluation. And I guess what I'm asking is, was that done and will we hear something about it?
There has been a root cause evaluation. I am not aware of the conclusions from that, but we can certainly present the conclusions to this board.
I think it's important because that is one of your most significant issues at the facility, and the fact that you did do a root cause, I think it would be of interest to us to know what the root cause actually identified.
Steve, would you mind checking on that and either in conjunction with somebody's presentation today or tomorrow, or if you can give us some enlightenment sometime.
All right, I look to see if we can follow up in this public meeting format or at a later date.
Yeah, if somebody can, or if you can just give us a status report and we hear it later on, that would be okay. But if somebody is ready and can make a few comments, even if he doesn't have all his slides, that would be good.
Understand.
Okay. All right, the last afternoon, page 24. See where you start the Nexus discussion. You had defined the question mark. Yeah, there's no need to do that. I mean, SAP is soft. SAP is SAP. So, 25. The second paragraph that starts with these sounds is a Swedish software. Does it need a word like program, software package? Just to clarify what we're saying here. Okay. 26. Almost to the bottom, I said something about LARA, and I think it should read, I support using a LARA concept as a motivator without the emphasis on, and then I would make the words read, on comparing collective dose between plants. And I'll give you that.
Okay.
Okay, 28.
Mr. Chairman, I have a similar question, and I'll ask it now, and it's to do with the sentence below the bold print on 28 at the bottom of the page. And we had talked to Ms. Jacobs about her participation, as is stated here, in an executive task force, part of the recent NEI program in community relations. She indicated that she was involved in that, or at least the initiation effort. And I would appreciate it if we could get some sort of a brief update on where that's going, seeing as how it's addressing itself to community relations, and of course that's part of why we're here. So perhaps if there's an opportunity, someone could address that, is what's happening, where is it in life at the moment.
Will Vice President Jacobs be here this evening?
Yes, she will be here for the evening format.
Could you give her a heads up? We'd appreciate just some kind of a bit of feedback on that item.
I will do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
29. And nobody has any comments on the fact that the meeting was adjourned. So, okay, those who have pages that need to go to Rob, please make sure he gets them. And we can then have a motion to accept the minutes.
I move to accept the minutes.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. We are through with that item. We can now move to action items. And the one we want to deal with this morning is the annual report. Furman, do you want to start the discussion on this?
I will. I guess since August, we've been writing and reviewing various drafts of the annual report, and I've sent to members and consultants the executive summary within the last week or so ago. And so that's open for any comments and approval, should that be the case.
Okay. Member comments. Bill.
Maybe you could call on someone else as I straddle through this wide table here to define
the same problem.
Okay, I found mine.
All right, you're up.
I just note that I provided comments by email, and I'm actually happy with the executive summary.
I've got those and have incorporated them. Thank you.
Bill?
Yes, just a second, please. On page ES6, item number 12, we have some underlined material here. The very last portion of that sentence, to effectively initiate line organization, I would suggest we scratch the S. Line organization response to identified issues.
Take the S off of organization.
Well, that's my suggestion.
Yeah, sounds reasonable. All right.
And let's see, on the very last page, on page 9, RO6-1, management should place special emphasis on operations achieving green quality performance status in a timely manner. I would suggest eliminating the word permanently. I don't know how we can really judge that something has permanently taken place.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I look at it, I think you're right there.
Okay. And on 6-3, the second line where it says those just required by regulation, I would suggest we roll those and say just those required by regulation.
All right. Got it.
And that's the extent of my comments, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Compare you
yes.
Comments?
I already provided comments by email.
Sheila? Jim?
That was a very good report.
And I'm satisfied with the executive summary as amended. So, Fern, is there anything more about the annual report for information that you wanted to mention to us?
With your approval today, I will go back and make all the minor changes and editorial changes I've received from everyone. And I will then pass the package on to Rob Wellington, both a hard copy and an electronic copy. And if any members or consultants would like a copy of the report electronically, I can include them on that as well. Or just the executive summary or whatever you'd like to have. And then Rob will take it from that point, have it copied, bound, published. And he'll also send the report to PG&E, who will have, was it 45 days?
Yes.
To look at the conclusions and recommendations of the committee and respond back to the committee in that time. So those are the next steps, basically.
So for Kent and Steve, that 45 days is supposed to give you guys enough time to find out who has to respond to the various recommendations and at least get a first cut of those back electronically to us.
I understand that shouldn't be a problem for us.
Okay.
If we may, we'd like to get an early start on those recommendations. So, Mr. Wardell, if you'd send that to me, we can take a look at those and get some advanced work going on that.
Okay, and we'll let the 45-day clock start when Rob says he's got the finalized report.
So that's correct.
You've got a grace period that you can use.
Correct. Thank you.
That's good.
I'll take care of that. What I'll do, Kent, is I will send you electronically, if that's okay, the parts with the recommendations in them. And once it's approved here.
Okay. Let me ask, since we've got paper copies of this material, is there anybody who would like a paper copy of the final annual report? You will all get an electronic copy. Is there anybody who would like a paper copy of the final in addition?
I would.
I will.
Sheila? Jim?
No.
No?
Kirk? Yes, I would.
No.
And no for me. So there's two requests.
Okay.
I'd rather have mine on electronic.
That's what my hard drive is for, preventing use of so much paper.
Furman, I'd rather have a CD and hold it by
my right.
Yeah, we'll all get that anyway.
Yeah, Rob's office will provide each of us with a CD.
Rob's copy is a lot of times you can't do anything with it.
Right.
You can't change. You can't do anything. Where is
no,
yours?
But this is the final one.
I know.
And that's
but if you use it, if you use it to help make up next year's report,
you can copy page out.
Yeah. Yeah. You should be. We should. Yeah,
that's fine.
That's a good point. We should also distribute the members and consultants the Word version because it is helpful sometimes to have it to use as a template.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean the print version?
Right.
Yeah, the Word version, that would be good.
Yeah. All right. I'll send everyone on the committee the electronic Word version of the report when it's ready.
In summary, now, the annual report of the committee will be in final form and will be distributed in the coming couple of weeks. It will be available on our webpage, right, Mr. Wellington?
Yes.
And so for members of the public who happen to see this television version of this meeting, if you want to see our annual report, the easiest way is to go to the committee's website, and you will be able to find it and look at it at your leisure.
And we also file a hard copy with the library at Cal Poly.
And I believe the website address is www.diablocanyoninfantsafety.org.
Correct.
Good.
Okay. A question, Mr.
Yeah.
Chairman. Is there any reason to discuss the members who have been appointed by various organizations within the governmental structure, to discuss whether we as members should be appearing as individuals and presenting the annual report to the organizations who appointed us to these positions?
Good point.
It has been the custom since the committee was organized back around 1989-90 that each member should try to go to his appointing state official and provide them with a copy of the annual report and be there to answer questions and have a chance to discuss any issues that they might wish to discuss. Now, logistically, this hasn't been real easy all the time. You're dealing with state officials who have very limited time on their agendas, but it is something we would like to do, and the annual report is...
And then I think if people cannot... I mean, sometimes arrangements can't be made till much later. We might go ahead and if it can't be done by December or January, then we would actually just proceed to file those directly with your appointing agencies.
Yeah, between now and the next couple of weeks, this is an election time and officials aren't available. So let's see what we can do. But we only have one more fact-finding meeting and one drill, right, the rest of the year.
But Dave, you'll want to wait until we get the PG&E response to this report before you hand it to them.
Yeah, it includes
not
that.
Not a bad idea, yeah.
Yeah, the total report includes the PG&E response. So that the report, the annual report isn't complete until we have the response, which is the attachment from PG&E of their response.
Right. Okay, so we're looking at this spring if we're going to do something like this. Okay, but each of us will work with you, and you get in touch with us if you hear that there may be a way that you can set something like this up. All right. Well, we are doing so well that we're ahead of schedule. Let's move on to our financial matters. And
we're wondering if you approve the report.
Yeah, we should.
We need a vote.
I move that we approve the annual report as amended.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the report's approved. Thank you, Rob. Thank you. We're still ahead of schedule. Let's move on to our financial matters, and we might be able to take care of other committee business this morning and save some time tomorrow afternoon. But we'll want to try and start the consultant reports somewhere not too far in advance of 10:45. So we'll move it up a little bit if we can. All right, financial matters.
You were all provided copies of the financial statements from our accountant through October 11th, and I have extra copies there if someone doesn't have them with them, but I can certainly pass those out. This does not include the grant for the fourth quarter, which is just about hopefully to be received shortly for October, November, and December, which will be an additional $195,283. I went through and did a calculation of our figures to date. You can recall compared to last year, and I might go through those just real quickly with you. If you go over to the next two pages over, the one that says by event category, safety statement of revenues and expenses by event category, income tax basis, it shows the 10 months ended October 11 down in total overhead. You see the amount of $56,000. Last year that was $75,000.
down at total public meetings the figure of 140,000. Last year at this time it was 251. Total fact findings. Last year, you see there, this year the figure is
I'm
one.
I'm looking at a different page.
Wrong page.
Oh, this one.
I'm sorry. I'll wait till you're all in there. I'm on the, it's page 1, 2, 3, 4. Page 4.
Okay.
And on the third line, it says by event category.
Yep.
Okay. Let me start over then. We're all on that page. Okay. You see total overhead this year is 56,000. Last year at this time it was through end of the year it was 75,000. These were end of year figures.
End of year. Okay. Yeah, that's why there's so much.
That's why they're higher. Yeah.
These are projected end of year figures.
No, this is what last year was end of year.
And this is basically through the.
And this is basically
through October 11th.
Through September. Yeah, through October 11th. And I think most of the billings are in. I think everyone's billing, Furman's billings are in for the annual report.
Don't be too sure.
So end of year through last year, total expenditures, total overhead was 75,000.
Okay.
Total public meetings, we're at 140 now. Last year, the end of year was 250. Fact-finding meetings, 177. Last year, end of year, 227. Officials. And special projects and activities, that's 35 at present. Last year, through the end of the year, was 53,000. And I've got those figures, and I can make photocopies of this. I just did a sort of an annotation. Just it allows us to, I think, gives us some idea to see how we're doing. Obviously, I think we're doing very well. We certainly seem to have sufficient funds to get us through the end of this year plus. And the only additional expense we'll have this year, and I'll talk about that later, is there'll be some legal expense. We're engaging the services of our CPUC attorney in connection with the application for the restated charter. So there will be some expenses this year. And then again, it'll probably go into next year with the process for that expense. Any questions?
Well, I'd submit that we're not that far away from last year's totals.
No.
And we were within our budget last year, so.
Yes, plus.
That's good.
And we returned 88,000.
Yeah. So there is a chance we'll return some this year.
Absolutely.
Because we don't have too much scheduled for the rest of this year. We do have this fact-finding meeting, all of the expense reports coming in,
right,
and various other things. So it's really a little hard to project with confidence, but your projections give us an idea of where we are, and they look reasonable to me. So let's proceed on our planned basis.
Okay.
And we'll look at things at the end of the year. By the time we have everybody's billings up to the end of the year, it'll be in January sometime. So at the January public meeting, we should know how we finish in 2006.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Very good. Any other comments on the financial projections?
No.
Okay. Furman, let's go to the open issues. Open items. Discussion of issues on the open items list.
Right. The open items list is contained in your meeting packet on the bright yellow pages. This is identical to the electronic version I sent out last week to all members and consultants. Page 2, and you'll notice up at the top of page 2, the third item, I'm saying we should close that. Item EN-29, which deals with the engineers not being able to get funding for their systems.
So that's not very descriptive, then. But the point is we've covered that now, and we don't have to keep it on this list.
Yeah, the point here is that I consider the item closed because the The station has their plant health committee in that process, which is pretty effective based on a couple of fact findings we've done in getting the funding prioritized into the systems that need it. Now, it's not to say we won't keep following the plant health committee process, but I'm just saying here we can close this as an open item.
Any objections?
This relates to, for example, fire protection health. And there's been some deferral of maintenance in this area, so I think we might want to carry it forward just a little bit longer.
I think that particular item is in the open items list in another place.
Okay.
The reason we had this was the need for kind of an overall look at things. And as Furman points out, the Plant Health Committee, its activities really takes care of this need. So I don't think we need this one, but we will have the fire protection item.
Over on page 4, we address the fire protection system specifically.
Okay.
I'll show you that when we get to it, if you're concerned just with fire protection.
Well, I'm looking here at EN29, which includes the discussion around fire protection, and it's one of the ones that we need to keep open someplace.
I agree. If we get over to fire protection on page 4, we'll see if that doesn't satisfy.
Okay.
If it does.
What are you going to do with EN29? You're going to close it too, aren't you? Well, you say you are.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the point is that we can now focus on particular programs rather than a blanket program. If we see one that we want to attend to, we'll have that on the open items list rather than the generic thing. Okay?
Right. EN29 really focuses, as it says here, that the capital approval process appears to be the problem. So they've got that pretty well squared away.
Good.
But we'll pick up fire protection in just a few minutes on a few pages over. Okay, page 3.
Before we go to page 3, page 2.
Page 2.
HP 22, the...
No.
Furman and I are here next week for the graded exercise.
And that's when you plan to have that?
Yes, that's on the agenda already.
Okay.
That's on the agenda for Paramount.
Thank you.
Okay.
Lisa, I think it's on the agenda.
Yes, it is.
Good. You're probably right.
I thought so.
Yeah, we discussed that, and that's good. That's an important thing.
All right, page 3. There's the updates here on page 3. Page 4. You notice the very top pull item, SE32, the 12 kV system. I'm suggesting we close that. I think it's getting the attention that it needs.
I agree.
Not to say we won't review it again, but I think this item can be closed.
You cool with that?
I'm okay with that.
Again, thanks to the Plant Health Committee, I think this system is getting more attention than it would have otherwise, it seems like. Now, if you look down near the bottom up here in particular, under fire protection, that FP5, mm-hmm. There's where I address reviewing the system. Talk about the system health being yellow and that an action plan has been developed and we should monitor it. Does that take care of your concern, Pierre?
Yes, I think that the key issue has been the dates for getting this fixed have kept slipping, which is of concern.
Right.
Up at spent fuel storage installation, just a couple lines up from that, we're going to hear about the status of that today. Is there an item in your fact-finding on it? It also says 10-6 fact-finding.
Right. Here and I plan to, that's on our agenda as well. We'll talk to Gerald Strickland about that. We'll actually go out and tour the construction with Gerald. That's on our agenda for next week.
Well, we may do a lot of that today, or today and tomorrow. So why don't you take a hard look after you see what we find out today and tomorrow. You might be able to do something else.
I'd still like to get up there and see it because the construction has been moving so rapidly. Getting a chance to follow it during this process has been, I think, it's been important to keep track of it.
So okay. Yeah, it's a lot of difference of walking up there and having time to walk around and actually see that than just hear a report on as you're driving by.
Yeah.
Well, will we get up there on the tour tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well,
we haven't seen anything that would suggest this warrants continued attention by us, I think. So we can consider closing it.
All right. Closed. That's SEC-2, by the way.
Yeah.
Chairman, I had a question or a comment or both on SG-12.
All right.
The second line, steam generators and any increased safety margins, I would suggest that we also add the word decreased.
Increased or decreased.
Okay, yeah. Good, good comment, Bill. All right, I'll make that change.
I think as we get closer, and particularly when we're in the process of the actual replacement of steam generators, it's somewhat like the spent fuels storage facility. I think it will require fairly intense scrutiny, just because things will be happening pretty quickly during that period. So this will, I think, be one of our more important items to be following closely.
If we have a fact finding during that and have an opportunity to get a good look at things, yeah. And you should. I mean, there will be a period when the containment will be open. And the only question is, that's a very busy time at the plant. I'm not sure that they'd be able to support a fact finding. So that's something you'll have to take up with Kent when you try and schedule something.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the board committee consider next year for these fact-finding issues, since safety margins will be evaluated, analyzed, and largely go into the design change process. So the timing's right for next year, as opposed to during the installation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point.
Okay, page 5. Page 5, about halfway down, is where we start with our public meeting items from the previous public meetings. So the second one there, I suggest we close that, Bill. Is that acceptable to you on the grid reliability? I'm on the February 05 public meeting item number 2.
Yeah, I agree. I think that can be closed.
The hypot testing, we looked at that back in September.
Hypot's okay. That's clear with me.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. And then what's left here are the 7 items from last meeting. And let me address the ones where it says waiting PG&E. Kent just provided me with the information there. The first item, Vice President Jacobs, in response to a question from Mr. Conway, agreed to verify if the AMSAC, AMSAC, was in the TS, the tech specs for DCPP. They are not in the tech specs, but they are in the equipment guidelines, ECG's equipment control guidelines, I think it's called, which is similar to tech specs, but it's a document that controls various equipment set points that is not subject to the NRC approval process like a tech spec would be.
Okay, you know, it's either in or out, but I guess I'm just curious that you really have no regulatory demand as to whether this piece of equipment is in or out of service. Out of service, not a problem. Maybe a problem operationally, but from a regulatory perspective, it's not a problem, obviously, because it's not in your tech spec.
That's not exactly true. Equipment control guidelines are used for equipment that is considered very important to safety, and there are action statements associated with equipment out of service.
Okay.
As earlier stated, the NRC allowed licensees to put a number of equipment categories into the ECGs to allow them to make changes under 10 CFR 5059 rules.
Okay.
And there are very strict surveillance and outage times associated with those. They look and they feel, and we treat them just as we do tech specs.
Okay. I guess that's really what I was looking for, whether you had anything in a mandatory sense with respect to operability of that system, recognizing that it's a transfer without scram issue.
We have not had any issues associated with that.
But you do have governance, if you
absolutely,
will.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And that was what I was after.
Yeah.
That's fine, thanks. I'm okay with that.
Okay, well, then can we mark that settled?
And yeah, I'll put that,
okay
take that out.
Yes.
Right, the next one, number four, we talked about earlier today, that's the, well, it's not an LER, but we call it an LER there on the ERDS. And Kent has handed me the report on that this morning. I'll get copies to the committee. And the second is visits to the plant overlook site, and we will go to the plant overlook site tomorrow on the tour.
Fog permitting.
Weather permitting, that's correct.
What about the two above that?
Which ones?
The two that Stan Kettleson was involved with. Did you decide what you're doing with those?
Item four?
Well, the item three we picked up in the minutes, so that's gone.
Yeah, we can close that, don't you think?
We got that squared away in the minutes.
Right. That's going to move to our guidelines, actually. Item four I just discussed, and I've got that right up here, which I'll give to the committee today.
Oh, okay.
The ERDS.
All right, I see.
That's closed. I'm on item five.
You just did five, didn't you?
Right. Closing five.
Yep.
And six, I'm thinking, that's the backup power supply for the Nexus application. I'm thinking that Dave, you and Jim talked about that in your August fact-finding meeting, perhaps.
It's in the report.
It's in the report. Yeah.
Right, so you can go ahead and close that.
And they've got that.
So we can close that one.
And backup power for the Nexus system, and they're well set for that.
Correct. Close that one. And the final one, item seven, has to do with the gagging of the main steam safety valves. Bill, you had a question on that. And yep. The answer is that the applicant does consider the valve inoperable. If it is gagged.
Yeah. But once you decide to declare it operable again, there's nothing you do to ensure its operability. Is that a safe statement?
That's correct. There is no post-maintenance activity to verify. And really what we're looking for here is the valve is closed by application of a design feature. And it's opened, and it has been shown by numerous industry tests this doesn't have an impact on the set point of that valve to lift when required to actuate. And it is controlled by our plant technical specifications.
The whole thrust of my question on that was the assurance of operability. If, in fact, you declare the valve inoperable, that has to permit you to think that nothing has happened, for example, to disturb the setting of the pilot valve or any of the other contributors, if you will, to the fact that the valve will open when it's required to open. I understand the analytical piece. I'm talking about the mechanic who walked away and kicked the pilot valve.
Really, what could happen is we could damage the seat if it was excessively seated, quote,
sure.
gagged, and,
sure.
and that would become self-evident by
sure.
additional leakage. And in
sure.
that case, it would be outside its, yeah. its set point tolerance.
Yeah. I would have assumed that that was probably the answer because I deliberated on that myself in the days when I used to work for a living. And I always wondered in the evening when I was going to sleep, how do I really feel about the operability of these valves once I know people are working on it?
So, right.
I'll accept the answer because that's the way I'm sure the industry does it. I was really trying to get a sense of where you people were with respect to the understandability and the assurance that the valve was physically okay once people
removed the
had
gag.
Hands on.
Yes. Yeah.
It would be very awkward to require a test after you take the gag off.
Well, that depends. Yeah. It depends on the status of the
well,
line.
Yeah.
The plant.
But testing those valves is a
that's
a serious matter.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to do it unless
you
have good reason.
You do them off-site.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm talking about any potential physical impairment. that can be associated with having done work on a valve?
It's a great question, and I recommend that we look at this at a future fact-finding. I believe we have data that shows that we have gagged the valve and then ungagged the valve and did in-situ testing to verify that it has, in fact,
okay. Now you said some magic words. That's okay. That's different. Okay. Yeah, and I agree.
We could definitely follow up with that in fact-finding.
That's a good suggestion. Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Before you leave this area, I have two suggestions on category descriptors, if you don't mind. Let me run them past you folks. One is on page 2, under PIL, it says performance improvement, open parentheses, learning, close parentheses, programs. I would like to recommend, and consistent with some changes we made in the annual reporting structure, to refer to this as learning organization and performance improvement programs.
Up with what we have in the annual report.
Yes, it does.
All right, I would agree with that.
It's certainly more reflective of the clarity that has entered the annual report in these areas.
Yeah, we took some pains in the annual report to get the wording just right, so this should reflect those same words. I would agree.
Yes.
Good catch, Sheila.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have one other question, and that's with respect to LD3 on page 4, the very bottom line. Review technical operations and accredited training programs. And I've not done this, but maybe someone could help me in terms of how do we review accredited training programs?
How do we as a committee, Bill?
Yeah. And we're charged with doing this annually. But I'm wondering how do we review accredited training programs?
Well, in fact-finding meetings, typically, we'll go observe operator training class. That's what we have been doing in the past. I can't remember the last time we did this, but we do talk to them about their over-year training. We try to do that annually. That's about the limit I can take of that we do.
We certainly don't duplicate the accreditation process.
Well, I'm just looking at the wording, I guess, and I have to believe that there's...
That's what you're referring to.
Well, I don't think we have the capability of doing that.
Yeah. We don't.
So I'm not sure whether it's a wording issue with me or not, but I know it's virtually impossible without having a knowledge of the accreditation process that you could actually review an accredited training program.
Yeah, it's not certainly a formal review.
I think our focus is on accredited training programs that the people at Diablo Canyon have taken. I don't think we review the accreditation. We just look at the fact that Diablo Canyon personnel have taken accredited training programs. At least that's what I've done.
Oh, you mean check attendance lists?
Yeah, we just see how many have gone and what kind of programs our people have been engaged in, the people at Diablo Canyon. We don't review the accrediting process. For instance, it might be accredited an accredited training program by IMPO. We don't review their accreditation. We just look at Diablo Canyon people, the members that have taken the courses or programs.
Hmm. Okay.
That's my perception.
We could also review the IMPO report on accreditation programs when they come in and do their...
Say that again?
We could review the IMPO whenever they come in. Of course, they don't come in, every 5 years on training. That might... But whenever they come in and review the accredited programs.
That's
perhaps saying something like reviewing the results of an accreditation team report, something of that nature that sort of is a go, no go, whether you're meeting the accredited standards or not. But I don't.
Right. But then there are also.
The way it's stated here, I think we probably should think about rewarding it somehow.
Because I think also Sheila's point is important reviewing. Who's getting accredited training, and how it's being used? That is, whether or not who's getting what sort of training programs to assure that in fact there's sufficient training activity underway. That makes sense as something that can be reviewed, and the scope would be reasonable.
Let me tell you the reason I'm sensitive to it. There's been an issue around the facility for about a year now. And I don't want to use the word untrained, but people are performing functions that they haven't been trained to perform. Would you agree with that? And they're principally accredited training programs. maintenance,
in general terms, I would agree to that.
Yeah.
There have been...
And that's been flagged by your own QV people.
Right, right. And it's really around the verification that individuals are qualified.
Mm-hmm. Which is the same thing we're saying we're doing.
Yeah.
And that's where I find the hole.
These have been the exceptions rather than the rule. The point is that we have had reports on such findings.
Right. Since there has been no consequential outcomes from these, they are very, very important to us, and it is part of our accreditation process that people performing work are qualified to do that work. Mm-hmm. And we have actions in place to immediately turn that around in the positive direction.
Okay. That's the kind of thing I think we should be reviewing.
Mm-hmm. Will you work on some words?
Yep. I will. Okay. Bill, how about if we get together after at the
sure.
break or something,
sure.
we'll come up with something.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Well, that completes the open items list, unless there are other comments or questions.
I'd suggest we take a break now, and then we get back together and we'll complete the public outreach and documents provided to the committee and begin our staff. Per, do you or Bill have anything under that item?
I don't know.
Any of the consultants? Rob? No.
No.
As expected. Kent, anything we need to be aware of concerning other committee activities that...
No, sir.
Yeah? Okay. Documents provided...
Dave, you may want to mention for the record about our public tour tomorrow.
Okay. On our agenda for this meeting is a plant tour tomorrow. And this is typical of what we have done for a number of our meetings, except when national security announcements prohibited it. And the plan is to meet at 8 a.m. tomorrow at the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, the PG&E Community Center. And Kent, you want to say anything about the tour? Any things we ought to be aware of?
Just a reminder of the safety caution. When we do get up to the oversight, construction is underway. Otherwise, we're ready to go and looking forward to accommodating somewhere around 50 of the public on that tour.
Is that two vehicles?
No, that's one large bus.
One big bus?
We have one bus that holds 58 people, and we have 50 members of the public. We had quite an interest from the engineering students at Cal Poly this time. We have a number of them. I can't remember what the number is, but I mean, I'm sure it's at least 10 or more. A lot of them called in. And then relative to the tour, you know, last time we pushed for the first time the use of the comment sheets, and we have a compilation. I don't know if those got sent out or not. I know that Kent saw a compilation of the comments of the feedback forms that we had, and I'll pass those out. It might just be of interest to you.
I'd like you to discuss it with us a little bit. You can pass them out, of course.
Yeah.
But I'd like to hear a little bit about that. And let's do that now. But just 8 a.m. is the agenda time. Now, the bus won't leave right then, but I would like all of us to be there a few minutes before 8 and be around there to show people around the visitor center and get acquainted. Right?
Yes, that's correct. There'll be a presentation or two at the community center, and then they'll depart somewhere between 8:30.
Just real quickly, and I'll pass these out. I'm not going to go through all of these. But I just quickly looked. We got comments back from on those forms from like something like 18 people, most of whom signed their names. About half of whom indicated that they'd like to be added to the mailing list for future agendas and information, which is what we're always looking for. Most people had, I think everyone had, very positive comments. You always have a couple people who, someone noticed they didn't check the overhead bins when they searched the bus, and a few suggestions for the ID check and handing out the name badges, which I think was something we're going to be doing differently. Other than that, some very nice comments. I'll pass those out.
Do you want to just pick one or two of the comments that you think are sort of typical and give us a feel for them?
Excellent tour. Well-informed individuals. More education of nuclear facilities to the public needs to be provided. PG&E needs to promote Diablo Canyon on the Discovery Channel to help educate the public. I am so impressed with the facility, and many fears of nuclear facilities have been answered. This was another one. This was a great opportunity to hear and see about the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. The presentation at the Visitor Center was very well done and interesting. We thoroughly appreciated the morning. Thank you. An enlightening experience that brought nuclear power to more understandable form and shows the extreme safety measures taken. So there are a lot of very positive comments.
Very good.
As I say, I think they're all positive comments, and there were, you know, as I say, they vary, and you'll be interested. One comment mentioning that Ellie certainly knows her stuff.
Great.
I'll pass those out later.
Okay, thank you, Rob.
Dave, for planning purposes for our January public meeting, I'll assume we'll go ahead and continue with the public tour.
By all means, as long as it can be accommodated. I think our charter, including outreach, says we ought to try and do it. We welcome other ideas for how we can improve our outreach and other ideas of things we might do, but certainly the public tour is at the top of the list for the time being anyway, and which means we'll want to schedule it every time unless there is an orange alert or something beyond that. And even if they say orange alert now, that's for airplanes, not for us.
Well, when the just to comment, when the you mentioned public outreach has now become, and of course the APG publication, which we now the televising of all of our meetings, which again is specifically required by the new PUC approval of a revision of our charter.
I'd also like to make a recommendation, which is that in addition to the public tours, in the past, before September 11th, we would also have tours of for engineering student groups who were coming in with a bit stronger technical background and benefited from having a more technically oriented tour. I think that if it's possible, this would be the correct time for PG&E to begin to, do that sort of thing, in part because it's important for the training purposes. And I don't think it's actually necessary to go inside a plant to get the benefits that come from visiting the training facility, and especially perhaps having a chance to see the simulator operate, see a few transients run on the simulator and interact with some of the engineers and other staff. But this would be something I think there would be some significant value, particularly given the fact that there's this very strong reemerging interest among engineering students in nuclear energy.
Steve and I will take that back to our senior management. The students are very important to us. That's where we're getting our new young people out there at Diablo. So we'll look at that along with our security needs and just see what we can do.
Right. Yeah. I'm
going to give Per a charge. Tomorrow, would you try and visit with some of the engineering students, particularly after the tour on the way back, and probe a little bit as to whether they think that a somewhat higher level technical tour would be a good thing to have for a bunch of engineering students. In other words, whether you would get not 8 Cal Poly students along with the other public members, but maybe have 25 engineering students on a tour where they could talk in a little higher technical level and see what their reaction is, and let Ket and Steve know about it and me.
I'll do that because I think that it'll be interesting to get their perspective, and then I can discuss a little bit with them also the additional things that's possible to do if you do.
What else we can support?
You bring up some excellent points, and I have talked with Donna Jacobs, Vice President of Nuclear Services. She is also very supportive of public tours and understands the value of those to the community and educating the community. So we've already had those discussions, and we're looking at ways to increase the availability of these tours to a wider population around here.
Now, it would not have to be integrated with one of our public meetings in order to do this.
No.
You can do that anytime.
Right.
If a member of our committee happened to be around and could join the group and add a little bit more perspective, that would be great, but it's not a requirement.
Right. I understand.
Another thing I'd mention is that in the past, when we'd have the normal engineering tours in the plant like this, we'd have the students would have a chance to go in and see the turbine building, essentially. But the radiation control areas were not accessible unless you had very special arrangements. And I think that from the perspective of setting up tours, that in fact one can from the education side can do the same thing by visiting fossil plants, and we have various opportunities to do that. In the past, we've gone, for example, to Moss Landing, or most universities actually have some sort of on-site combined cycle type of plant, so that you can see what a power plant looks like. And the most useful part of coming to the plant actually typically ends up being the equipment that you can see in the training facilities and the simulator itself. So a tour inside the protected area, I think, is really not necessary to get the benefits of doing tours down here in terms of bringing engineering students in.
On that point, this is something that we did at Commonwealth Edison years ago, but are there ever tours anymore of the Central Power Supply Office? All right. Now that you're deregulated, there's that big center in Folsom. But is there still a center in the San Francisco area?
Yeah, the Transmission Control Center, yes.
Yeah. We used to take small groups on tours of that, and it was tremendously successful.
the typical reaction was, I had no idea what it takes to supply power to people. And, you know, the guys running it, they're busy, they don't really like the interruptions, but on the other hand, they were delighted that there was somebody there who was interested in what I allowed them. Any other points? Ma'am? Okay. Documents provided to the committee. Rob, do you have some more for us?
No, just to note for the record in the minutes that you have in your rainbow packet, it's the... I guess it's the tan, light brown sheets are the cover sheets that just record all of the documents that the committee has received for review over the last quarter.
Right. I think we've had a chance to look those over. Kent, this item closes the discussion we were having this morning. Anything to say about it?
Well, sir,
this is the... actual wording from the action statement that covered that matter about the apparent cause and examination of the software problem on the process computer. Okay, SPDS computer is still really an adjunct. It's not a it's not a tech spec requirement either, is it?
It is a system that is covered by our equipment control guidelines.
Okay. Any other comments on documents? Okay. We've got about 15 minutes before we should start our next item. There are no members of the public here, but can we take a minute to move to an item that we'll have to cover tomorrow and start thinking about our schedule so that maybe we have to do any checking or anything. We can wrap it up in a short order tomorrow. We've got our scheduled events for the rest of this year and our public meeting right at the end of January, right? Let's get our dates up here.
Jim and I are going to do a fact-finding on the 28th and 29th of November.
On the 25th. And that we can't. That's going to be on the 25th. So we'll be here on the 25th, 26th.
Okay. Public meeting, January 31st and February 1st of next year. That's solid. We don't have any problems with that, right?
That's correct.
Okay. I have on my calendar June 20th and 21st. For the next public meeting.
That's great.
And that's still firm with you guys?
Yes.
With the plant? Anybody else? Any problems?
June 21st, did you say?
June 20th and 21st.
Let's see. Actually, I think I may have a conflicting meeting on the 21st. If there was any possibility to move 1 week earlier in Boston.
And the ANS is in Boston the following week, so you're pretty well locked in there.
Yeah, so.
Now, that wouldn't really be helped by moving it to the 19th and 20th, would it?
Yeah, in general, the Wednesday, Thursday, I think, dates work better. I'm not
sure. Well, I mean, it may be easier to do that than move it to the previous week if we...
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that is true, actually.
If you find that to be a problem. What's your take on that? What do you want to do?
Actually, in some ways, I think maybe just moving to the week 1 week earlier, if people could accommodate, that would be the best thing to do. Simply because it seems that given the plane schedule and getting people back and forth for PG&E, that the Wednesday, Thursday dates tend to be the best. So,
is this something you could check on, Ken? See if there's a possibility of rescheduling that?
13, 14?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we can handle that.
Would it be possible, if we move it the week before, would it be possible to do it the 14th and 15th? I've got a family reunion that week.
What I'll do is I'll look at the 13th and 14th and get back to you next week, if that's all right. That gives me time to check all the officers' schedule.
Jim's point was, could we consider the 12th and 13th?
No, 13th. No,
I'm sorry?
14th and 15th. 14th. Thursday and Friday.
That would also run into the same sort of issue because the Wednesday, if we do 13th, 14th.
I'd prefer 19, 20, given the choice.
Okay.
I would too.
Okay, well, let's put the 19th and 20th as the first choice then.
That's fine. I'll put 19th and 20th first. Have to confirm that with our officers and get back to you.
Okay. Fact findings in January, February, March. Anybody have any dates lined up? Anybody got anything set yet?
Jim and I had actually been looking at the potential for fact-finding in December. The potentially doing one that would be linked into NSOC meeting that's going to be held on the 15th. And this would be helpful for me because in the spring I'm going to be teaching two courses. And so if I can do something falls outside of the next semester, it'll be easier in terms of scheduling to get people to cover my classes.
So are you looking at 14th and 15th?
14th and 15th was what we've been looking at. And that links into the next NSOC meeting. I think maybe this year's budget will support it, and then it may cut back on what I need to do the next spring period when I've got the teaching commitments.
And Jimmy, that's
fine.
Good by you? Okay. Kent, that's one to see if you can confirm. That's fact-finding level, so
yeah,
it
fits with the NSOC, so there will already be things happening here.
There won't be any problems.
Well, and since we were talking February for the public meeting, that leaves a possibility in January. Well, let me work on something for me in January. And then March and April, March, April, and May, we ought to probably do one fact-finding a month. So, everybody take a look at their calendars.
Oh, look at
March. February 19th, our IMPO evaluation begins. So, there's a two-week time period preceding that.
What was that date?
February 19th.
So, if Bill wanted to come, then early March would be okay, probably.
I would think that would be okay.
So I'll do January, and if you'll do March, and then we'll try and get that set up.
If I could go in May. Instruction ends on the 8th, so for Berkeley, and that allows me to not impact the teaching because I'll have done December and then in May.
Then. Okay.
So I'll take on a May fact-finding.
All right, then it's up to each of us to try and organize those dates and coordinate with you. Okay. And maybe we can even get one or two of these confirmed tomorrow if we happen to be able to. I want to look at calendars some more.
How about the October? I'll sell it.
October public meeting.
About the 17th and 18th.
We had not been setting up any dates yet. Wednesday and Thursday? October 17th and 18th?
Yeah.
Anybody have any thoughts on that? I have no idea at this point.
I can't do those days. I can do the week before or the week after.
Jimmy? That's
fine, either one.
Take your choice.
Probably the week after, if it's confirmed in the annual report.
Either one's fine.
Yeah.
24, 25?
Well, that's October, yeah. Let's look at that then. 24th, 25th. Everybody do a calendar check and Kent do a kind of a preliminary check there, and maybe we can set it. Might be even be able to keep with it. Okay. Anything more on scheduling? We'll save those other information items for the end of the meeting. We're just about on time for our staff consultant reports.
You set it up first for me.
All right. I'll report on the September 6th and 7th fact-finding meeting that Bill Conway, Sheila Scheinberg, and myself performed. Now on the screen is our agenda. I've also given the committee handouts of that agenda. We started out with a review of the 12 kilovolt system review with the system engineer. There is some history of that system having some problems, which the committee's been following for some years now. And the 12 kV system, although it's a non-safety related system, does provide some pretty important loads, like to the reactor coolant pumps and the circulating water pumps. The system actually has been in green status for about the past year, but now has been rated white due to some things in the system, mainly with transformers. So there's some bushings that have been degrading, which they'll be going to be replaced. Oil leaks around some of the oil field radiators due to the corrosive ocean atmosphere nearby. The salt water tends to corrode the radiators. They get leaks which have to be repaired. They're going to now replace those radiators over a time period. There have been some startup control circuit isolation problems between the two units, and us caused some tripping circuits, nothing safety related, but still a nuisance, and that'll be repaired. Be separated, actually, the two units. And then finally, the underground loop, which provides power to the administration, training buildings, those sorts of things outside the power block, has had some trips on it, and that's going to be corrected. These, I believe, have all been approved by the Plant Health Committee, and they believe it's going to take a while, probably through 2011, to reach green. It's just a long process to replace a lot of these cables and make some of these corrections or radiators. The system is in maintenance rule A2 status, which means there are no significant maintenance rule items outstanding on the system. So the system's in good health. It's just got some problems they're having to deal with.
Can't it reach green without having every one of those repaired? And aren't some more important than others?
Some are more subjective call, but in this case, I think it's reasonable what they've done.
Okay.
We toured the system, which mainly consisted of looking at transformers out in the yard and some switchgear. Everything looked pretty good. So we saw the pinhole leaks that they'd repaired and others, so they're taking care of that situation. And Bill, jump in at any time if you want to comment. I'm sure you will. The next thing we looked at was transmission grid reliability. And basically here we didn't look directly at the reliability of the transmission grid, but we did talk to the system engineer and an electrical system design engineer. And they had put together a response to an NRC generic letter called Grid Reliability and the Impact on Plant Risk and the Operability of Off-Site Power. And basically by looking at this pretty large question and answer document, we got a good idea. We got the conclusion that the system does meet NRC requirements for off-site grid stability. And the analysis or the answers discuss such things as protocols between the nuclear plant operators and the transmission system operator, or the TSO, what grid conditions would trigger a notification from the TSO, training and testing of plant operators regarding the grid, certain voltage conditions that would be, would indicate a degraded condition, operability of the emergency diesel generators and nuclear safety loads in the plant, those sorts of things, and how that affects the grid reliability. And then how the grid of reliability, having trouble saying those words, are part of the maintenance activities at the plant. And basically, I think we concluded that the system met, system and programs met NRC requirements. We then looked at reactivity management with Jim Welch, the new operations manager. And reactivity management, as the committee knows, is something we've looked at for a while. It's a program to assure that nuclear reactivity, or that is the core, basically, is maintained, isn't controlled. Operations had performed a self-assessment of reactivity management in early 2005, and there were no findings considered to be quality-related in that self-assessment, but there were some actions that were taken to improve the system, and those are listed in the report, which I've, I think I've sent to everyone. I wasn't going to go over those unless you want to get into some of those items right now. Like I say, they're not quality-related issues, but they're items, process computer, which we talked about. They depend on that pretty heavily for the reactivity management calculations and controls. That's being changed out, as we know, so that'll be a plus for reactivity management. Some of the improvements they're making look pretty impressive. I think they're doing the right things, and we basically concluded that the program was in good shape. People are doing the right things. The reactivity management leadership team is effective. They do have a set of performance indicators, and based on, it's more like an index based on several factors. And these have been green and white over the past year, and overall they're just below their goal of 98% with a 96.8% measurement. So they're close to being at their goal, and for August, they were at the 98%, so they're closing in on goal.
Were you guys satisfied with the performance indicators measuring what they should be measuring?
Yes, although, you know, when you look at an index like that, it's hard to look at the index, the 98%, and be able to tell anything without looking below the below those numbers. So you have to dig deeper. And they basically are measuring reactivity events that they have at the station, any deficiencies, and areas for improvement. They also put results from self-assessments, operator workarounds. Those all factor into these indexes, so you have to look beyond just the number.
These are more, have we done the reviews we're supposed to do? And do we have our procedures in place and stuff like that?
That's part of it. But they also measure events and severity of events.
Yeah, and count the events. But you got a feeling from other things that you saw and you said a moment ago, they're doing the right things. Do these indicators really tell you that they're doing the right things? Or are the indicators just kind of too simple to do that?
They're probably generally too simple to do that without looking at the program. The most important one, of course, I think, is the events. You know, by having no events or very few events, that's a good thing. That tells you they're doing things right, preventive, that sort of thing.
Well, I think it's important also to note that the issue of almost events is also something that's captured. So it's not just we need to pursue it, and not feel that because you're at a 98% number that you know, you've already conquered Mount Everest.
All right. The next item four is the IMPO type mid-cycle self-assessment. We looked at that. That's going to be on the agenda later today, so I won't go into details there if that's okay. Number five is the boric acid control corrosion control program. And we've looked at this a year to a year and a half or so ago and concluded that they had a solid program at that time, but had some work to do as far as making it as effective as they could. They had a leaker list for what the program does, basically, is it identifies and tracks any boric acid leaks in the plant and puts them in the corrective action program to be corrected and tracks them. They've got a procedure. The procedure looks comprehensive. The program health is in the green category, so it's they've measured it as green. It's just into the green category, basically. And some things are some of the sub-parameters, performance indicators, are white because of some equipment problems that they've had. One is the Rockwell-Edwards valves, which I think, Dave, you and some of us have looked at those before, where the packing followers have been replaced. And there's been no corrosion damage, but that has the potential for corrosion. And it's going to take a while. Those have been, I think, replaced, and it's going to take a while for those to roll off the 18-month rolling average. So that's keeping them white. There's some other things which they are needing to do, but overall they are just in the green performance status. They plan a self-assessment later in this year. It may have already started, but there'll be a self-assessment of the program this year. So that'll be something we want to look at next time.
Do they keep finding boric acid indications? Is this just expected that there will be some now and then?
Might let them answer that.
The program, as you know, continues to inspect for and identify boric acid leakages. And, yes, we do find those. By and large, they're very minor leakages. When I say that, you can see a small dusting of boric acid around a valve that has been recently operated, for instance. All of the areas that we identify that have more of a generic...
Just a little bit at the last public meeting. And the 4KV system is actually in yellow status now, because of two cable degradation issues. One is some contaminants may have been introduced into the manufacturing cable jackets during the manufacturing process back in the early 70s. And they're finding now, I think this is an industry type of thing, that there's some insulation degradation in these underground conduits. They've had 10 failures in the past, and the corrective action is to replace all the cables. And about half of them have been replaced, and the others are scheduled to be replaced by outage 1R15, which will be in mid-2009.
What sort of actual physical damage is occurring to this insulation? Is it like crumbling away? Or?
Well, again, what we have found, and this is with buried cables, based on a root cause analysis, both internal and external analysis by a vendor, we found that there was a contaminant. It's actually hydroxyl that was found in the insulation. Now, this is cable that's been underground for 30, 35 years. So what we determined that in combination with water, this hydroxyl can expand, and what you see is a breakdown of the insulation. So over time, 30, 40 years, the insulation breakdown can result in a short occurring in that cable. Now, other actions that we've taken, in addition to replacing the cables, all the safety-related cable first, and second, the non-safety, is we've taken extra measures to ensure that there's no water in these conduits. So, obviously, you need both to have that, and we've removed one of the factors that would lead to failure.
How's the physical condition of the conduit itself, then?
Actually, well, we're talking cable within conduit, first off. But the cable is very good condition. We recently pulled, two outages ago, the reactor coolant pump, 12 kV cable. And it looked, it was sitting in water, portions of it. And the insulation did not look good at all. And we did a high pot test on it and tried to fail the cable, and we could not fail it. We went three times beyond the rated for the cabling. So by and large, these continue to perform their function. However, it's a vulnerability we want to eliminate completely.
Yeah, Bill and I talked to the engineer about the high pot or high potential tests that they did. And they did. These were cables that they were tested in place.
Water issue with buried cable in
you've probably noted it, but certainly the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been showing heightened interest, if you will, in what various facilities are doing with respect to discovering this problem and trying to take care of remedies. So it's not just here, it's become rather endemic.
That's right. In fact, EPRI has recently created a working group specific to look at medium and high voltage buried cables.
Diablo Canyon is taking what they call a risk-based approach to resolving this problem, such that a minimum of one train of safety shutdown equipment for each unit receives top priority. So they're looking at it on a per-train basis. And although it's yellow now, they'll change to a white color when they get at least one train of each shutdown system replaced.
Hey, on so. These systems, is there any instrumentation to look for ground fault? You know, if you think about what we do with if you've got water around or the potential for grounding stuff in homes, we do ground fault interruption. I'm just curious whether that's something that's done or whether it's practical for these high voltage cables.
Yes, we do have that capability, and we do monitor for those alarms and have appropriate actions that we take upon an alarm. And we also do testing during the refueling outages to verify that they're continuing to meet their function.
And so that means actually before you could get a bad short or something, there's a number of things you might detect that would point out that you're getting into trouble.
That's correct.
All right. I was going to move on to the next item, unless there are questions here. The next item, number 7, is longstanding equipment problems. And this is on tomorrow's agenda, so I'd not plan to cover this here today, except to say that we did attend a Plant Health Committee meeting, of course one the committee has attended, I believe, and pretty effective meeting, it looked like. They handled the issues, they took them on, and made some good decisions, and a very effective, efficient meeting, we thought.
Who chairs that committee?
The maintenance director, Jack Perkis.
I'd like to make a comment, done deal. Now, on the other hand, nobody was in there seeking millions of dollars of appropriation, so perhaps that lent a little bit of a less than overly formal attitude associated with it. I guess my question would be, in what I tried to describe, would you conclude that to be sort of an exception to the normal Plant Health Committee performance?
Well, I was not present at
right.
this particular Plant Health Committee meeting, but I can tell you that the committee, like this committee, prepares before the meetings, goes through the items, and largely has most of their questions answered before they even appear, because the agenda is fairly full, so they need to be efficient with their time. So it may have appeared that some of these decisions were just a matter of fact and pushed through by the chair, but his role is to move through the agenda, and certainly if there was an issue, I have to believe it would have been brought up and debated at that time.
Okay, I guess what I hear you telling me is most of any issue that could be raised is probably raised pre-meeting, so that issue resolution has already occurred, and therefore we're not into a debating session, if you will, before a vote is taken.
To the extent it can occur, yes, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. By and large, that happens prior to the meeting. The agenda comes out days before, and everyone is expected to review the material and be prepared to either ask questions or get their answers before the meeting.
The reason I asked the question is that even this morning, this committee has given credit, if you will, for issues that were on our to-do list, or your to-do list, that were remedied by the existence of the Plant Health Committee. So I for one, just want to be certain that what I saw, and I tried to preface it by saying it's the one and only time I've ever attended one, that the fact that we are given credence to the existence of the committee and the fact that it is in a position to solve problems that weren't solvable before, let me put it that way, that what I saw was sort of an aberration and not necessarily the standard type of plant health committee, where hopefully some activity would take place and some exchanges would take place to make this really what it's projected to be.
I can tell you those do occur, but I would offer
a number of engineers we've talked to at the station are getting money for their systems via this plant health committee process. So.
I do just have to add one thing, just for clarity. The plant health committee was put in place as a result of an NCR root cause analysis, and part of that process is to during an occasion look at the effectiveness of that root cause corrective action. Mm-hmm. So we continue to look at that, and we would appreciate any feedback that you have on that to make sure that that's meeting the intent of that corrective action. That's part of our program.
I've given you my initial feedback. Hopefully, as I said, it was something that is not the norm.
All right. I'll move to safety culture, if we're ready to do that. Bill, you ready to move on to next one?
Actually, I'm ready. Back to that? Because I've had some questions back when we were going to close out one of the open categories, which was EN29, and the response was the new plant health committee process is working to aid engineers in getting funding for their systems appear satisfactory close item.
And it seems from the discussion here that maybe there's still some concern that the plant health committee requires some further monitoring. So do we really want to close out that previous item if there still may be some issues?
Well, I think, I'll give you my view, I think the previous item was pretty much associated with no vehicle at that time existing that could help the engineer solve his problem. Mm-hmm. Now I think the vehicle is in place, and I would only suggest that we continue to monitor the activities of the Plant Health Committee and see if it's really doing what the NCR, as you suggested, wanted it to do when it formed it. That would be my suggestion.
Okay, I guess that's a question that I would have, and I'll discuss it later on when I make my presentation. Furman talked about some of the 12 kV system was not going to be fixed for quite some time off. We talked about the fire protection system not going to be fixed for quite some time off. And one of the system health reports that we reviewed was going to be fixed till 2012. We asked the supervisor why, and he really did not have a good answer on that. I'm wondering if the plant health committee is really looking at the timing on that.
Advocate for a change that typically requires some sort of funding to change. And we have a process that ranks and scores these individual items. And the Plant Health Committee will review the scoring of that particular health item and agree or disagree as to whether or not it meets the criteria to go to the Plant Review Committee, okay, which is the Vice President committee that will look at the health issue, the ranking of that health issue, and determine the appropriate spot to fund that particular item. So it's a two-step process. One is we concur with this. This is a health issue. It needs addressing. We agree with the scoring. It goes up to the PRC to determine the appropriate timing for that item to be funded.
And that would be something like I'm holding up now, where you actually, in some mathematical fashion, you've concluded a ranking by priority.
Right, based on vulnerability, yeah. Consequences of failure, how long has the item been out there unaddressed, mm-hmm. things like that.
Is this looked at on a rather routine basis, or is this a one-time publication? Because that vulnerability can change based on what may have happened this afternoon.
Absolutely, and it is routinely looked at.
Okay. And somebody has decided that fundamentally the way the rankings are placed are acceptable.
That's done at a subcommittee level, and again verified by the Plant Health Committee, the scoring and ranking. Primarily the score. We go through the score.
Yeah.
We know the process. We challenge it. If there's any questions or changes, we make those changes there and approve it with the changes, and it goes to the next the plant review committee.
I'm not trying to threaten the existence of the Plant Health Committee. I just think we should continue to monitor this beyond what we've already done at our last fact finding.
All right. Maybe I'll add an open item to the list for us to track a little more closely, the PHC.
I was at that meeting also, and I think, with your permission, my issue was not so much that there was the question of the outmandation. What's the process whereby there is discussion, there is input, there is diversity of opinion? That was my question. When I walked away, what's the process here? I didn't see a process. I saw outcomes but didn't really understand the process, or if there was a process. That is that what you were seeing as well?
I was looking for an interchange of opinion.
The process.
And, the process. And some of that, I suspect, is accomplished, as Mr. Chestnut indicated, pre-meeting. That probably did occur, and I don't for a minute doubt that it didn't. I just thought it was a bit of a very pro forma, cut and dried sort of application of expenditures of funds.
Yeah, and that could be.
I didn't hear any prioritization.
Yeah, that could be an outcome purely of the agenda items.
Very possible.
Maybe they were. I can tell you from personal experience, having been in those as the engineering director, we get in some pretty lively debates.
Good. Glad to hear that.
All right, we'll carry a new open item then to capture, Bill, what you and Sheila were saying.
With monitoring.
We'll get some more visitors.
Yep. Okay, ready to move on to the next one? All right, we're going to cover safety culture and safety-conscious work environment. We've tracked this for some time, the committee has, and we were glad to find that Diablo Canyon has both a new program directive and procedure which define and control, well, I shouldn't say control, but at least define and provide responsibilities and expectations of management and everyone at the station as far as their safety culture goes and their safety-conscious work environment. The procedure and program directive are pretty thorough in that they define in no uncertain terms safety culture and safety-conscious work environment, and I've included those definitions in my report verbatim out of the program directive and procedure. We talked with Rick Burnside, who heads up the Employee Concerns Program, about the safety culture. He, in his own words, is the, quote, safety culture subject matter expert and program facilitator, unquote. That's his job at the station. Jim Becker is the officer assigned responsible for Diablo Canyon safety culture. It was Donna Jacobs before, last time we looked at it, and that's been shifted over to Jim Becker now. So those are the ultimate responsibilities for getting the program as well, any results of these surveys. So we didn't get a feel for the safety culture itself because we didn't have any survey results to look at, but I think that's something the committee ought to look at in the future. We were pretty encouraged by the fact they had the program directive and procedure. They look good. I think they're on the right track there. Also noticed that NRC, and it's June 2006, biennial inspection on problem identification and resolution and assessment of safety-conscious work environment concluded that they thought Diablo Canyon had a positive safety-conscious work environment at the station. This is based on interviews they've made of personnel during those inspections.
Is this from NRC teams that specialize in this area, or is this a collection of observations by the resident inspector?
I think both, Dave. I think the teams that come in and do this biennial problem identification resolution inspection, I think those are people from outside along with the resident inspector. So they're experts in the area, I would have to say.
Let me also respond to that by saying My understanding is that inspection focused more on safety-conscious work environment than safety culture. I think they're still developing expertise in safety culture.
That's correct, it is.
Yeah, that's my perception.
All right, so we were pleased with what we saw there on safety culture, and I think the committee should continue to monitor this. We next looked at the equipment qualification program, which we've looked at before. This program was green, and I thought it was running well. Equipment qualification program assures that any safety-related equipment will meet, be able to work in the environment it might be subjected to in a post-accident environment. There were some problems a couple of years ago with it. They've corrected all that, best I can tell, and it's just an ongoing system. Interestingly, the steam generator replacement project will actually change some of the temperature profiles for the loss of coolant accident and streamline breaks in and outside of containment. So when that when the steam generators are replaced, other equipment is going to have to be replaced too that'll meet the higher temperatures. So that's an outfall of it. And found that their processes for corrective action were effective. They had no findings of significance on the program. Mr. Over did say there were two things that he felt like the plant should be doing with the corrective action program. One was better line involvement. That was getting more line employees involved in the program. And second is the quality of resolution of corrective items actions. So those are the two things that they're working on as far as their corrective action program goes. Those are two things the committee should follow up on.
I'd like to just make one comment, as long as we're on corrective action programming. I guess I was a little surprised, greatly surprised to hear that you didn't complete the containment fan cooler modification, knowing that that was one of the issues that the NRC was really concerned about with your problem identification and resolution program, Cornerstone. But for some reason, that job wasn't completed, and I thought it was intended to be completed during the outage. Can you speak to that at all as to what happened there?
I can give it just a brief summary real quick. We had been pursuing a modification to the fan coolers that would basically prevent reverse rotation of these fan coolers. Obviously, it's something that we're into the design change process being very thorough, and the testing that we have associated with that was showing that it wasn't as straightforward as we thought. Consequently, in the refueling outages, we implemented, several lower level design changes to the fan coolers themselves to correct the issue and improve some of the maintenance practices around it, and had a team actually dedicated, a design engineering team and a maintenance team dedicated to work on those. I feel, and subsequent inspections during power operation have shown that we've largely corrected this issue. We're going to continue to look at this anti-reverse rotation coupling to see if that proves to be feasible. But the actions that we have taken have corrected this issue. And we'll continue to monitor for that.
Well, that's a little bit different slant than I guess I heard at the fact-finding meeting, wherein I was told that the actual design change or the corrective action wasn't completed. And that's what, I guess, piqued my curiosity. You're saying it was completed.
Absolutely. I personally inspected the fan coolers myself.
That's interesting. And
Now there could be some additional enhancements that we're going to continue to pursue to further bolster the design, but what we intended to do was completed.
Okay, and I apologize for raising it because I raised it having been told that it wasn't completed. And
maintenance that we performed have returned that device back to its safety function, its required safety function. We're going to look for further enhancements down the road just to ensure that long term we don't have this issue again.
Well, that's better news to have heard it from your mouth than from the mouth I guess I heard it from.
Okay. All right. I'll move now to item 11, quality verification audit of the software quality assurance program. Another item the committee tracks. Software QA program is a program at the station to assure that all software used for safety-related calculations and other functions is controlled properly, does the right kind of job. So basically, we looked at the audit, which was completed in mid-2005. The audit found the program to be effective, and there were no quality issues out of the audit. There were two action requests that came out of the audit. That's where two I call them sub-plans or sub-programs were out of date at the station. I've identified those in the report. And they were just a matter of getting those up to date with the current procedures. So I thought the audit was satisfactory, and the results showed the program was effective. We looked then at the vendor manual program. This is a program at the station to assure that vendor, equipment manufacturer, mostly manuals and drawings are up to date and can be found for the various pieces of equipment. There had been some problems back in late 2004 with people being able to actually get the current manual or the current document for the installed equipment. And they'd written an action request. And they took two corrective actions, which are of note. One is they have improved the whole process now to make sure it's clear who's supposed to do what. That wasn't clear in the previous program. And secondly, and maybe more importantly, they've undertaken a vendor manual review program where Diablo and an outside consultant are going back and looking at all their vendor manuals to be sure they have the latest manual for the installed piece of equipment. Quite a big task, but it needs to be done, and at the end they'll have assurance that they do have the right and up-to-date manuals.
Are a lot of plants at the same stage in this, or some further ahead?
Other plants? I don't know. We didn't check on other plants, but this same vendor, or this same consultant is dealing with the manual in lots of cases to work on equipment or as it's installed.
But increasingly they're going to be electronic.
Well, the electronic one is what tells you if the paper one is still up to date. Because there's a date on the paper one, and if the electronics says no, there are changes made, then obviously it's not up to date.
Well, they're going to undertake this review. It's a three-year review, and then they'll have updated their program to be sure the manuals are good. They rate their vendor manual program now as in the white category, which is satisfactory, and it'll be green by the end of next year as they get this program completed. All right. That pretty well concluded our planned agenda. Now, item 13 was not on our original agenda. This was an event that took place about a week before we got there, and I think we'll probably hear more about this evening. I'm thinking the Unit 2 reactor vessel in core instrumentation thimble leak. Basically,
he says yes.
He says yes, okay. So unless there are questions, I won't go into that necessarily. And then Bill met with Donna Jacobs and then separately with Jack Keenan to talk about what we covered in our meeting and some other items. And that pretty well concludes the report.
Well, you know, I had a very, successful meeting with Mr. Keenan. Thought that went very well. It was the first opportunity I think any of the members of the committee have had to have a sit-down, one-on-one discussion with Jack. And I think it went very well. And the meeting with Donna was relatively short, not as long as we normally would meet, but she had other issues pending. But by and large, I thought it was an excellent opportunity to talk to Mr. Keenan, and just appreciated the opportunity to do that. Worked out quite well.
All right. Well, that concludes the report, and I had sent the report to the committee, I think, a week or two ago, asking for any comments, and I would ask for approval today if you were so inclined.
I didn't have much in the way of comments. We've had some discussion. and you've got a few things to update.
Yeah.
I'm okay on it.
Yeah, again, with the comments that I sent by email, I'm happy with them.
Yes.
I've never seen this. Yeah, I didn't.
I'm going to report on the fact-finding meeting that Dr. Ross and I conducted on August the 2nd and 3rd here at Diablo Canyon. We've sent out the report for everybody to review, and I've gotten comments from everybody. I've got some new comments today from Bill and from Furman, and when I incorporate those, that'll be the final report. The first item that we looked into was with Dave Taggart, who is the manager of QV Quality Verification, to review the first and second quarter QPAR, which is Quality Performance Assessment Report of the year 2006. That's going to be presented tomorrow in detail, so I don't think I'll go into a lot of details on that presentation he gave us, except two comments, really. Is I think all of us have said in the past that the QPAR really identifies a lot of the problems. It identifies strengths for a lot of the problems at the plant. But it appears to me that these same problems get identified over and over. And also, if the line organizations were performing their self-assessments correctly in detail enough, they would be finding these things rather than QV continuing to find them. And I guess that bothers me that QV is the one that continues to have to identify these problems and not the line organization identifying these problems in their self-assessment program or any other programs they have in fixing those. I don't know if any of y'all have any comments there or not.
I'd like to say it a little differently because a lot of the things that QV finds, they find from the line organization. But QV highlights them. And I think the concern was that some of these are things that the line organization ought to be speaking out a little bit more about them as they're fixing them, rather than saying, okay, we've got it under control. And then QV says, well, they have this problem and they're working on it. But sometimes I guess there's a little tension in this arrangement.
It's a very good report. I guess I wonder sometimes what kind of attention it gets after the report's issued. What kind of attention does the line organization get? I know they're supposed to respond to them.
And in addition to their own surveillances that they do perform. So it is a combination of things that may appear as if they're repeated, and in some cases they're not. Some of the issues require response by the line department with follow-up actions and dates associated with those. Some are a little more subjective and treated by the line as hey, we need to look at this, and they're taking their own initiative and direction to address the issues. So not all of them require a response, but in all cases, there is an individual department sit down with the leadership of that department, discuss the QV issues and insights and areas that they're identifying, and there's good dialogue there and agreement with the conclusions of that assessment.
I had a question, I guess. I'd like you to be forthright with me. How does the line organization view QV?
That's a high, hard one.
Yeah. Shouldn't be a high, hard one at all. Softball.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the softball. I would say, generally speaking, the QV assessments have been judged as insightful and utilized. In other cases, there's disagreement. So,
sure. Healthy.
And it's usually very healthy. So I'm not going to go and say they're viewed as a necessary evil at all. They're viewed as playing a vital role, and we all are aware of that role, and we address the issues and concerns that are brought up.
So the line believes there's value associated with what QV does.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that, yeah. I guess that leads me to believe that if there is value associated with what they do, and there was general agreement on what they have described or identified, that there's really very few reasons why work shouldn't be accomplished in order to fix the problems.
I would agree with that statement.
Okay, thank you.
One other item is it's going to be on the agenda this afternoon, that they had not issued the second quarter QPAR, but Dave Taggart did bring up one issue in there, and that was where that they did a verification of the analysis in response to the NRC generic letter on containment sump debris blockage, and they found quite a few problems in the analysis there. And that will be discussed here this afternoon, so I'm not going into any detail. But QB did a good
useful job.
I'd agree, yes.
I would just say that this issue has been around a long time. It's confusing to a lot of people, not in the sense that they don't know what it's about. It's in the fine print. I mean, when you really get down to what you actually have to do and why, that there's still a lot of disagreement among people as to what is necessary to do. So pretty soon all the plants are going to have to do something and get it approved, but we're still not up to that point yet all around.
Next item we reviewed was an update on the outage safety plan. Diablo Canyon had actually reviewed their outage safety plan and did major modification in the year 2005 because of a lot of the concerns of the loss of coolant during the outage from other plants. So they had made major modifications to it. Then IMPO came out and asked the whole industry to do a self-assessment on their outage plans here this year. And Diablo Canyon performed that in March through June of this year. And while their revisions covered most everything that IMPO had asked them to do ahead of time, they did have some improvements that they were going to make. And they're going to make those improvements before they start working on the outage safety plan for 1R14.
I'll just add another comment, and that was that one of the big issues, and we do mention this in our report on the fact plan, was the after shutdown cooling, after shutdown defense in depth, so that you still need cooling, and how much do you need, and when, and the details of this are still something that people are working on. It's been around forever.
Right. Our next topic that we reviewed was a LAR, which is as low as reasonably achievable.
Before you get that parrot question.
Actually, that was one of the questions I did have on the fact-finding report. There's discussion of loss of cooling events out in industry during refueling. I was just curious what those actually involve, because, of course, loss of cooling can be a very serious thing to have happen.
He did not cover any of those. That's something we probably want to cover at the fact-finding meeting to ask him to go back and do that.
Let's talk a little later.
Okay. That sounds good.
The LAR of 2R13 was presented at our June public hubs, and also tried to eliminate all of the entries and re-entries in it. And it was really a team effort between all the people to really work toward a plan to do the work with the least amount of exposure. Dave, you want to mention anything?
Yeah, I think that the number of people entering, they tried to assure that the people who were going to make an entry really had to make an entry. And that's important. But that's really not where much of the dose comes from. I think there was something that rang my gong before we got into this, and that was a comment from a PNAC meeting with outside members on that panel, which really had a comment that the radiation protection plan was not meeting expectations. And so I began asking why. And this goes back before the last outage, but there really wasn't much of a reason. These people are actually working very well to find ways to reduce those without compromising what they have to do. And the major thing that came out of this discussion with them was employee awareness, not just training, but signs in the corridor and awareness of paying attention to radiation signs and barriers, trying to think about where you are and what you're doing all the time, and just keeping it in everybody's mind. And I think this is very good. I'll take a moment now to just put the rest of the area which I got to involve with. I brought along some graphs, and I don't have copies of them. Maybe I can show some of you at the break. But part of the issue here is very low doses and numbers that accumulate and begin to look visible, but they're still very low doses and they're not in the health range at all. My concern was that a plant that has a little bit higher collective dose and an outage in a given year all of a sudden is in a worse quartile than a plant that's almost exactly the same. And the performance indicator is nothing but collective dose. I drafted a report. I got your comments back, and I decided not to include it in the fact-finding report for two reasons. One, a number of you said it didn't belong there. That was a pretty good reason. The other reason was that I only had a set of data that was broken down by individual entries. In other words, if a person went in and got one MR on that visit to the containment building, there's a entry, one MR. There's no identification of the person. It's just another entry. When you compare that, looking at the dose that was accumulated in 1 milligram increments, and 2 and 3 and 10 and 20 and 30, you find out that a lot of the dose came from these individual entries where somebody went in because they had to get something, they had to observe something, they had to be on hand for something, came back out, got almost no dose. And when you look at it that way, you find out that you really are looking at a lot of doses that are quite trivial. When I arranged the data by individual so that if one individual entered 20 times, he had 20 entries and 20 bits of dose, the graphs are different. And I'll show you these when we have a minute and talk about them rather than take a lot of time now. But the 1, 2, and 3... milligram entries kind of get lost in the wash, and there's a much bigger grouping of doses in the 5, 10, 20, 30 milligram range. Again, meaningless as far as health effects, but quite visible as a data presentation, which means that the first analysis I did was far from the whole story, and so I wanted to back off and do a little more looking at it before going any further.
Okay. The next topic that we reviewed was the status of the self-assessment program, and Gary Close, the program supervisor, first talked about training. Is they're doing a lot more training for the people who are conducting self-assessments. They feel like they'll get better self-assessments out of that way. They're scheduling the self-assessment for the first half of 2007 now so they can train these people ahead of time. They have not had the time to train them in the past. So he feels their own self-assessment reported that they had made improvements in the self-assessment program, but they still need to make improvements in their benchmarking. When they go to other plants and look at some particular programs, they need to make improvements in their benchmarking to the same level of improvements that they've made in their self-assessment program. Next item discussed was the engineering workload management status for project engineering. Jack Shelders, manager of project engineering, discussed this. They split engineering into two groups about a year ago. One was to focus primarily on the daily plant support, and the other was looking at the long-term range support. And that's the design engineering group. It includes design drafting, plant support, fix it now program, and the project group consists of mechanical, piping, electrical instruments and control, civil, seismic, and outsourced, and that is where they contract work outside. The engineering workload is currently about 3,300 action requests. action requests, AARs. And they're tracking this by sections. So each section of engineering tracks their own action requests, what their own workload is. And they've established a limit of 30, what they call 30-80 limitations. That is, they'll have a maximum of 30 number of design changes to be done during each outage, and then no more than 80 non-design changes in work at any one time. And they're currently got about 110 design changes, down from 200 from last year. So they're trying to reduce the work in the engineering department so they can keep up with it better. I think they've made improvements in better organization, better management of due date changes, overdue actions. They're looking at that a lot more attention than they used to, and better management of the projects and daily managed review of all the new ARs that have come in to prioritize those. The next item covered was the Employee Concerns Program and Different Professional Opinion Program. Met with Rick Burnside, the supervisor of that group. This year through August, they had received three allegations from the NRC to investigate. They investigated these, and none of these were substantiated. And they've had one internal concern, which also was not substantiated. They've had 28 low-level contacts that they've looked into. The Employee Concerns Program is a confidential program, so you really can't go into a lot of detail about what these concerns were.
The point that we asked Rick Burnside about, why aren't you getting more, you know, a larger number of employee concerns than you used to, and his feeling that more were resolved at the department level. Have you got any insights on that?
I don't, but I know Rick, and I know the program and the training for this program for the supervisors, and it is something that's the desired path, is to work with your supervision, address the issue. And I don't know if Rick has any particular data to support that, but I know that is what he does, and he looks at that very carefully, because we don't want any of this stuff to go underground at any point and to resurface later on. So it is an attribute of the program we want to continue to monitor.
And he also reported that the mini-employee survey they sent out here recently, the safety culture sort of supported his idea that if people did not have any problems of raising safety concerns.
And we do conduct multiple employee surveys, anonymous surveys, things like that. We have anonymous drop boxes for things, so anyone that has a concern or issue can get it to the right people to get addressed. So
he did report that we asked about the different professional opinion program hadn't been used since 2004. And his answer is why it's not being used is, here again, he feels like if there's any different professional opinion, that that's being resolved at the engineer or the professional level and their supervisor, and so it's not going into the program, that those are being resolved. Next topic was to review the system health reports that were rated either yellow or red in the instruments and control electrical system engineering supervisor. As Herman said, green is satisfactory. Why it is satisfactory, that they've completed all the actions to correct it, but they want to see the trending to be sure it's continuing to improve. Yellow is unsatisfactory, indicates that the system has major performance health issues with action scheduled for implementation. Red is also unsatisfactory, to indicate that the system has major performance and health issues and actions are being developed but not being implemented yet.
Jim, wasn't there one also that was put into yellow simply because it had been in white for a long time? And
there were some of it. I guess they've got a little different direction from management about how long something.
And we get them. We get action plans created, and focus on them.
He discussed six of them, which are rated yellow, and all of them. We looked at the system health report, and it had an action plan in there and an implementation and a date when to fix that. Only one of these we brought up a question about, and that was the unit, both unit 1 and 2, 480 volt vital and 9 volt electrical power system was rated yellow. But it's not estimated to be complete until 2R17, which is 2012. And we asked him why it was taking so long to do that, And he said, that's a good idea. I don't know why it's put out so far in the future. And so he was going to look into that for us. We didn't get a report back as to why, but anyway. That's here again, I assume that the System Health Committee is looking for these dates that are stuck out there real far. The one red is the Unit 1 and 2 plant process computer, and they're scheduled to be replaced. These are just like all computers that get obsolescent as old, and so, but they actually are scheduled and ordered to be replaced.
Jim, the one that's not going to be, is it white or green until 2012? Is it green or white?
It was yellow.
They won't achieve yellow status until 2012?
No, not going to achieve white to 2012.
It wasn't going to be fully resolved.
White until 2012?
Right.
I mean, they're starting to do something, but there's a lot of work to do, but we asked them to find out really why it was going to take that long.
Was that a safety significant system?
Some of these systems were non-viable systems.
Okay.
Yeah. And even though they're rated either white or yellow or red, the systems are still operable. This is just a rating to try to set priorities about how they're going to fix them, what they're going to do. Isn't that right, Steve?
Absolutely. In many cases, these are heading off some already known obsolescence issues. Vendors no longer supply spare parts. So we would put that in an action plan to identify alternate vendors, alternate designs, things like that. So in some cases, they are forecasting an issue and bringing that into the system health discussion.
The next topic that we discussed was the intake structure. Proof of the intake structure or the floor is you go out there where the revolving screens are. And they were doing a tremendous amount of repairs out there and also installing cathodic protection systems. The system engineer has been concerned about the delaminations and the corrosion of this the intake structure here for quite a few years. And he's had a very difficult time. They would inspect it and look at it. He still could say that it was structurally okay. It met all the requirements, but it was continuing to deteriorate. If they didn't do something about it, it was going to be a lot worse. The System Health Committee, and the health report really helped him out this time to get attention to that. And so for the last few years, he's been recommending that they start working on it, and they have not approved that, but he is getting money approved this time to do the work. That's also going to be a presentation tomorrow, and we'll have a lot more details about that.
Yeah, we were impressed by the point that he made, which is like a number of things in nuclear, where he had to say whether he had confidence that the system would continue to perform. And he told the Plant Health Committee that I can no longer keep saying that. You got to get this underway, because by the time it's all done, I can't say that it's going to be really in good shape unless we get this program going. And they agreed.
Yeah, so he was very pleased with the actions of the System Health Committee.
Jim, as I read the report, it sounded like to get the attention of management for approval for his repair work, he had to write an action request against the process they had for getting funding.
That's a good point. He did. He wrote an AR to point out that the process was not working. He was not getting approval for it.
It's like the waste program. You know, can't get a waste confidence statement out of the commissioners.
Yeah. The next item was to review the Nexus project changes, and Nexus is the Nuclear Excellent Information System. We had a presentation of that at the June meeting, but there's a few items we wanted to cover on that. As they reported in June, is they've delayed that project until June 30th of 2007, and so they had to revise all their training schedules and the people who are going to be trained. And they've got an outage coming up here next year. It's going to be right in the middle of all that, so they've got a challenging program to be sure the proper people get trained in time to accept this program. And we did look into
they rescheduled
early that morning, and unfortunately,
we didn't know about it.
We didn't get a chance to have the second review of it, Bill. So I'll give you some report back. The comments I got from Furman and from Bill here today are editorial type. So if I, after I make those, I would request that we approve that report.
I'll move that the committee approve the report.
I'll second the motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. We got a report. Rob, it's almost noon. What do you want to do? You want to defer or?
No, I can be. I'll be quick.
That's good.
I wanted to just update you on the status of our filing with the PUC, our application for a restated charter. You know, we have discussed this at least two prior meetings, and you've all seen drafts. You might recall we originally called this, we talked about calling this a revised charter, but we're not revising anything. What we're doing is really compiling all of the sort of disparate provisions for the that have applied to the operation of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee, starting with its creation back by a decision of the PUC back in 1988, which was a result of a settlement agreement amongst the parties at that time that provided for this committee. In 1997, of course, the PUC set aside that settlement agreement, which it provided for the pricing basis for the operation of the plant. And, of course, it took away, but they left the committee in place, but some of our provisions and in the initial settlement agreement fell aside. And then, of course, in 2003, with the rate case that PG&E had, the Mothers for Peace had a separate petition that the parties all agreed to consider, and that resulted in some further revisions with regard to how our members are selected. And, of course, there's some language with regard to our the requirement of the members and also the provision for public outreach. So what we've tried to do, and we've had this goes back almost 2 years. We started with meetings of all the interested parties, which included the governor's office, the attorney general's office, the energy commission, PUC, including the ORA or DRA, the Mothers for Peace, TURN. We have the same representative, and the parties all got together to discuss combining this and getting the appointment. October protests and responses are due by the end of November. A pre-hearing conference, if any, will be sometime in December, and we expect a draft decision in sometime at the end of January, and hopefully a committee decision sometime at the end of February. So that's the process for that, and it's proceeding as outlined.
Now, Rob, I assume no. From reading that, correct me if I'm wrong, the way we operate continues the same.
Correct.
The way a new member is picked will be a little different.
But that's true, but that's already been changed in the 2003 rate case.
Yeah, but was
we were compiling
was it really followed?
Well,
I don't think
was
so.
It was sort of observed in the breach.
Okay.
And in fact, then the parties all agreed actually to the short term, just to get the so that all of you are operating under appointments, which you now are, rather than being lame ducks after your 3 years. There was a process, and Bill had a short term appointment, and he's now been reappointed. But it will clarify and get back in order the process for your appointments as established by that 2003 rate case.
One other point also. I guess there is one modest area where our operation has changed, and that's in the area of the public outreach requirements.
And that was part of the 2003
rate
case.
Oh, we're already doing
that.
Yeah.
And we're doing that, yeah.
And, yeah, that was as required. But all this does, it takes all of the separate pieces of paper and decisions and so forth that have sort of you had to have a large file and put them back in, one document, which they were when we were originally created by the settlement agreement in 1988.
Okay.
Just quickly then, a couple other things. We have we received information just mainly from the media that PG&E is planning on appealing the Ninth Circuit decision with regard to the circuit's decision on terrorism considerations, but we haven't seen anything specific on that.
I maybe also to mention that now the Ninth Circuit has also reached a very similar ruling against the biosecurity facility that they want to deploy at Lawrence Livermore. that would have the capability of working with pathogens.
Right.
And so it's now, the Ninth Circuit has been extending this to other facilities as well.
So I, as I understand, PG&E has appealed that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's correct.
And then we've also just received some, again, information we get. We're on the
Okay.
That's all I have. I have one more. I mentioned when we were talking about the annual report, I mentioned the hard copy. I forgot that we put this on a CD now, and so, or DVD or whatever it's called, the CD. And so this is what you now deliver. What we actually file a hard copy with the San Luis Obispo Cal Poly Library along with this. And then when we've taken, I think in instances where we've taken up the two-volume set to the member entities and we give them this option, they usually let us take back the heavy set. So this is what we're now providing is in this format now. That's all I have.
Any other comments from members or consultants? If not, we stand adjourned. We'll reconvene at 1:30.
So we get some action.